This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Many Japanese Americans who had been imprisoned during World War II remained silent about it for decades. But in the 1970s and 80s, they and their descendants spoke up. It was known as the Redress Movement, and it's been seen as a model for other communities seeking justice and healing today for wrongs committed by the U.S. government. During World War II, 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry were forced out of their homes and into remote camps around the U.S. They hadn't committed any crimes. Nevertheless, they lost their homes, their livelihoods, and their freedom, living for months or even years surrounded by barbed wire and armed guards. Japanese Americans who relocated to the Midwest played a big part in getting justice so many years later, and their fight is documented in a new online multimedia exhibit. It's called Reckoning. The project is part of a collaborative grant undertaken by the Japanese American Service Committee and the Chicago Japanese American Historical Society. Reckoning was written and produced by Catherine Nagasawa, who joins us now. Kat, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'd also like to welcome Lisa Doy, president of the Chicago chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League and a PhD student in American Studies at Indiana University. Lisa, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thank you.
I'd also like to welcome Emma Saito Lincoln, Legacy Center Director for the JASC, the Japanese American Service Committee, and Project Manager for Reckoning. Emma, thank you for being here as well.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So Kat, I want to begin with you. Why did you decide to undertake this project?
Yeah, I feel like there were a couple reasons that motivated me to tell this story now. I think one of them is just that this fall is the 40th anniversary of some historic hearings that happened at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago. These were called the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians hearings, CWRIC. And this is where over 100 Japanese Americans from across the Midwest testified about their incarceration experiences during World War II. Many of them are doing this for the first time. I think another reason that motivated me to tell this story was I think that this history has renewed relevance since the topic of reparations has come up in the public conversation this past year in a more substantial way. I think in particular, there's been increasing political support for H.R. 40, which is the first legislative proposal for reparations for the African-American community.
Yeah, and I want to come back to, you know, sort of this idea that the redress movement sort of can serve as a model for other movements seeking reparations today. But and we also have some sound from the those hearings you were talking about at Northeastern. But we're coming up on a break in a couple minutes, so I want to save that for after the break. Lisa, let me ask you, when we're talking about the redress movement, this was 30 or 40 years after World War II. Can you talk about how it got off the ground?
Sure. I think there were a range of precursor moments. There was an effort to repeal Title II. There were early pilgrimage movements, so opportunities for survivors and their children to return to incarceration sites beginning in the 1969 with the first Manzanar pilgrimage. And I think with the, you know, the rise of the Asian American movement in the 1960s, I think enough time had sort of elapsed and enough political forces had converged for the 70s to really be a moment where the Japanese American community built political alliance behind some form of redress, although that was very diverse. And that could then be expressed in the 80s through, as Kat mentioned, the commission hearings and then ultimately in the Civil Liberties Act of 1988.
All right, we need to take a break here. Let me just take a moment to reintroduce my guests. If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new project. It's called Reckoning. It's a multimedia history exhibit online, looking back at the movement among Japanese Americans for the redress movement, as it was known, to seek reparations for World War II era internment. We're speaking with Lisa Doy, who's president of the Chicago chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League, also Kat Nagasawa, a writer and producer of Reckoning, and Emma Saito Lincoln, who is a Legacy Center director at the Japanese American Service Committee and was a project manager on Reckoning. If you want to join our conversation, 800-222-9455 is the number. We're going to continue after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. We're talking about a new online exhibit and archive that highlights the experiences of Japanese Americans in the Midwest. They were critical in helping to get compensation for Japanese Americans who had been imprisoned by their own government during World War II. The exhibit is called Reckoning. We've been speaking with its creator, Kat Nagasawa, and also with Lisa Doi, president of the Chicago chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League. And she's also working on a PhD in American Studies at Indiana University. Also with us is Emma Saito Lincoln, Legacy Center Director at the Japanese American Service Committee, which helped to fund the project. You can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And Kat, we have a clip here of Ross Hirano, whose voice is featured in Reckoning. Can you, before we listen to it, can you just tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, so Ross is a third generation Japanese American. He was actually born in one of the incarceration camps and as a toddler moved to Chicago's South Side. And he ended up becoming pretty politically active in Chicago throughout his career and was also an active member and leader in the Japanese American Citizens League Chicago chapter.
All right, let's take a listen to that clip.
My first reaction was, wow, now I understand why I have a picture of me as a baby in front of a tar paper shack. Now I understand about the scars on my uncle's back. Now I understand about the funeral I attended in Nebraska of my uncle being buried there. I understood all that. And it really was eye-opening. And as when I was coming back to Chicago, started thinking about that, and I started getting more angry, saying, gee, why didn't somebody do something about this? Why did this take place? Why didn't the community do something more? Why didn't they protest? So when I came back and asked my dad about it, and sort of saying, you know, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And he said to me, Ross, you weren't there.
So the context here is that there were generational differences in how the internment camps were discussed among members of the Japanese American community, especially with the younger generation who came of age during the civil rights movement, wanting to learn more, wanting to seek justice. But that wasn't necessarily the case among members of the older generations. Emma, I wonder if you can talk about that divide.
Well, I'm not sure I'm necessarily the best of the three
sure.
of us to
okay.
address that. My role is, of course, to be a champion of this history and to safeguard the materials that document this history. And I am of Japanese descent myself, but nobody in my family experienced incarceration. So I do think perhaps Kat or Lisa might be in a better position to speak from their
okay.
own family experience
sure.
and from the work that they've been doing.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. Lisa, let me put that question to you then.
Sure. I think, you know, one of the things I heard in what Ross was saying, particularly in his dad's statement that he wasn't there when, in fact, you know, Ross as a baby was present. But what I think his dad was saying is, you know, that generation, whether it's Nisei or Issei, the immigrant generation or their children, had to make choices about their own survival and about what kind of life they could have in America after this incarceration experience. And I think broadly speaking, Japanese Americans, particularly those who came to Chicago, really sought to assimilate as much as they possibly could as a means of protecting themselves and their children. And I think that's a theme you hear people talk about and grapple with in these commission hearings. And I think that's one of the things that Ross seems to be grappling with his father as well.
Okay, well, you mentioned again that these commission hearings, we talked a little bit about that before the break. Let's take a listen to, we have another clip from those hearings. These were at Northeastern Illinois University in 1981. We're going to hear Henry Tanaka, who worked in mental health in Cleveland, in Ohio at the time, talking about the psychological scars that Japanese Americans carried after their experience in these camps in World War II.
Our home was investigated by the FBI. The sukiyaki restaurant was vandalized. Consumers stopped coming. They felt it was unpatriotic. We closed the business. We were exploited. by people who bought our business and personal properties. Camp life then enforced again the feeling of being a second-class citizen. I became bitter. But I was determined to escape this prison-like environment. To stay in camp would have only heightened this feeling of bitterness. It would be difficult for me to abide by my parents' wishes to be accommodating, to face adverse conditions by patience and fortitude. After all, that's the way they survived in the first 25 years of their life in the United States. Luckily, I left in 1943 and went to Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana to finish my education. But even then, I was warned of threats of hanging and physical harm. But I decided that to remain in the godforsaken concentration camp at Tule Lake would certainly be worse than facing the irate citizens of Richmond, Indiana. At least I could be myself and not be one of 10,000 inmates. I would be free.
That was Henry Tanaka testifying in 1981 at Northeastern Illinois University at hearings about his family's experience in an internment camp. Kat, why had there been so much silence around that experience that Japanese Americans were subjected to?
Yeah, I think that there was just a lot of trauma experienced during those years. And like Lisa said, I think during the period right after the war, when a lot of Japanese Americans were resettling to other cities, they weren't allowed to go back to the West Coast for several years. I think they were just in survival mode, trying to start over again, start businesses, and kind of put it behind them in order to assimilate into the mainstream culture. And I think there was a lot of pressure to do so. And so I think the first generation and second generation Japanese Americans didn't really pass along those stories to their kids until the redress movement, which was, 40 years later.
And so, Lisa, what did emerge from these hearings? And maybe this is where we talk about the redress movement itself.
Sure. So ultimately, the redress or the commission hearings culminated in the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, through which there was a presidential apology for the incarceration, as well as individual payments for those who had been incarcerated and were alive at the signing of the bill. And there was a public education trust fund established to document and preserve the history of Japanese American confinement.
And Lisa, I wonder, we got an email from a listener who, when we announced we were talking about this on social media, they said the token Japanese American World War II compensation was only for those detained and still living. And the person said that a lot of members of that cohort were dying off. And they continue that they said that Reagan was forced into glory. He was going to veto, but would have been overwhelmingly overridden, so he decided to save face and sign. I want to come back to the question of whether this was satisfactory compensation, but first, how hard was the political fight? Was there a lot of resistance to this?
I think in reading legal scholars who've studied this, I think I would say maybe a consensus view is it was sort of the perfect storm of a lot of forces in which if any one of them had sort of fallen off, I don't think this would have happened. It was a time when there were four Japanese Americans in Congress, two senators and two congresspeople, two representatives. It was a time in which there was a large number of Japanese American veterans who were able to reach out to the veteran community. And it was a time when Japanese Americans mobilized through lots of organizations, through JACL, through NCRR, to lobby and to really put their stories out there as political pressure, as ways to, try to meet with as many congresspeople as possible and tell their personal stories to these congresspeople in the hopes that this would pass. So I think there was a lot of work put in, but I also think there was a lot of just the right combination of factors coming together at the right time that made this possible.
Emma Saito-Lincoln with the Japanese American Service Committee, you're the Legacy Center Director there, which and the JASC helped to fund this project. Can you talk about how this archive of audio is unique? I'm imagining stories from the hearings in Chicago. I mean, obviously the tape existed, but they haven't really been organized in previously.
Well, we're talking about the recordings of the hearings, which were actually held at NEIU. And I wasn't here when it happened, but I understand just a couple of years ago, those tapes were discovered. And the folks at NEIU very quickly recognized the importance of them. And so they managed to digitize them, and they are fully available online through the NEIU archives. You can both watch the video recordings and see the typewritten transcripts of the hearings as well. And this content is tremendously important. There are also recordings of hearings that were held in other cities around the country. So in some sense, this isn't totally unique material, but it is especially important for us here in the Midwest because it documents these voices, many of whom are no longer with us, speaking directly from the heart and in very emotional, moving ways about their own experiences. So while I am not the custodian of these materials, I can certainly acknowledge the value of them to us as a community.
Yeah, and I understand there are going to be some teacher training workshops. How do you hope people will use the project, Emma?
So actually, we already held two teacher training workshops, and this is a great opening to explain that the grant funding that enabled us to produce Reckoning and its parallel exhibit, Uprooted, also produced by CAT, the funding came from the National Park Service, which is part of the U.S. Department of the Interior, via the Japanese American Confinement Sites Grant Program. And we are, of course, very grateful for that funding. And it enabled JASC, in partnership with the Chicago Japanese American Historical Society, to pursue multiple legs of this one big project. And part of that involved digitization of pre-existing oral histories. Part of it was the collection of new oral histories. Part of it was transcription of oral histories and creation of a platform so that they can be publicly accessible. And then the final pieces are the more public-facing pieces like Uprooted and Reckoning, but also a comprehensive curriculum on Japanese American history that was created by our partners at CJAHS, and along with that, two teacher training workshops that were held in April. And there were some disruptions to the project due to COVID, as one can imagine. Mm. And one wonderful outcome actually was that by pivoting to virtual rather than an in-person series of trainings, we were able to reach teachers well beyond the Chicago region. The original vision was that we would be working primarily with CPS teachers. But in fact, we drew teachers from across the country at many different grade levels, mostly middle school and high school, but in a number of different subject areas. So engagement was really wonderful and diverse within the teacher community. We do hope to host more teacher trainings moving forward, particularly in light of the recent passing of the TEACH Act. And we've had conversations with the Chicago History Museum to perhaps work with them to reach their network of teachers. Sure. So the work is not done. It certainly continues, even though the grant has come to an end.
Yeah. Well, just about a minute left in our conversation. And Kat, can you talk about, I wonder what response you've gotten from people about your project Reckoning?
Yeah, I think it's sort of fallen into two camps for some of the people who are intimately familiar with this history. I think it was exciting for them to see it out there, especially because a lot of it had been living in their own memories, living in dusty archives in their basement. So I think it's been exciting to hear from the Japanese American community. But then also, I've heard from a lot of people who didn't even realize that reparations had been achieved before for Japanese Americans. And that's been really heartening to, know that Reckoning is a teaching tool for people to understand, one of the only successful reparations movements for historic wrong in U.S. history. So I'm excited for more people to learn about that.
Kat Nagasawa is a writer, or I should say the writer and producer of Reckoning. We've also been speaking with Lisa Doi, president of the Chicago chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League, and Emma Saito Lincoln, who is Legacy Center director at the Japanese American Service Committee. Kat, Lisa, and Emma, thank you so much for being with us and sharing this project with us today on the 21st.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Erica Scalise is our engagement producer, and special thanks today to Tanisha Spain. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening.